What is going on, sports fans? Welcome to Season 7, Episode 3 of the Jack of All Trades Sports Podcast. I'm your host with the most, Too Sweet to Be Sour, at the top of the hour. It's your man, Jack Burney, back with another edition of Jack of All Trades. Follow the podcast on Instagram at Joat Sports Pod. That's at J-O-A-T Sports Pod. You can rate the podcast, Spotify, Apple Podcasts. 5-star rating if you enjoy it. And of course, be a friend, tell a friend, share the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Hey, so we got a loaded show for you this week. Men's and women's Final Four in college basketball taking center stage. The men in Phoenix, the women in Cleveland. If you get the chance, any of my Ohio listeners, to go watch Caitlin Clark play this weekend, you should go do it. She is a generational talent. So I'll preview both the men's and women's Final Four, update who I have cutting down the nets on both the men's and women's side. Been a great March Madness tournament for both the men and the women. We're also going to talk some NIT. Indiana State comes up short in the NIT title game. I'll talk about what it was like covering their run and sort of how Seton Hall and Indiana State kind of proved the selection committee wrong since they were two of the first four out and they had such great runs in the NIT. Also, NBA, the regular season coming to an end. We'll talk about where teams kind of stand as we get towards the play-in, playoff territory. And, of course, the NFL. Never a dull day in the NFL. Stephon Diggs, no longer a member of the Buffalo Bills. Instead, he's in Houston with the Texans. Winners and losers of that trade and much, much more. We're going to start with baseball in a minute. Wanted to do an episode last week. Had to wait another week to do it. Been super busy with work, as I mentioned, covering the NIT and Indiana State basketball. What a run for Indiana State. And we'll touch on that now. I said we were going to start with baseball, but we'll start there. So the NIT, Indiana State, obviously they get snubbed on Selection Sunday, 28-6. They don't get into the NCAA tournament. I lobbied on this podcast and lobbied, obviously, to anybody who I've talked to about it. Since I cover Indiana State athletics at my sports reporter job in Terre Haute, I thought Indiana State was good enough to make the tournament. And instead of sulking and kind of being bummed that they didn't make the tournament, this team rallied around their coach, Josh Schertz. They rallied, the community rallied around this team, and they went on a run that was truly unforgettable. They beat SMU, Minnesota, Cincinnati at home in Terre Haute at the Holman Center. Three straight sellouts. The crowds were loud. The crowds were pumping. They beat three Power 5 opponents. I'm counting SMU as a Power 5 opponent because they're in the ACC. Then they go to the historic Hinkle Fieldhouse at Butler. They play Utah on Tuesday night. That was the last game I was at. Last night I was at the Morgan Wallen concert in Indy with my friend Gabe. Great time. I'll touch on the concert a little bit too, might as well. But Tuesday, they beat Utah. They score 100 points against Utah. Robbie Avila, who you guys might know, is pretty famous on social media. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Larry Blurred, Steph Blurry. Got all kinds of nicknames. He had 26 points and 10 rebounds. Then Ryan Conwell, the Indy kid, returns to his home city, and he has 27 points, tying a career high. So they beat Utah, and then it sets up a game last night on Thursday night between Indiana State and Seton Hall, and it was a fantastic basketball game. Seton Hall ends up winning by two. Tough loss for the Sycamores. Sycamores were up 77-70 with about 3 minutes left, and they didn't score the rest of the game, and Seton Hall won 79-77. But before we get into the run and what it was like to seeing this community kind of embrace Indiana State, let's talk about Seton Hall and Indiana State in general. So the selection committee on Selection Sunday, they leave Indiana State and Seton Hall out of the NCAA tournament. Seton Hall finished fourth, I believe, in the Big East, which in my opinion was one of the three best college basketball conferences in America this year. They obviously have UConn, the defending national champs, who probably are going to win this national championship as well. They have Marquette, they have Creighton. I think all three of those teams made the Sweet 16, but they don't get Seton Hall, and despite Seton Hall being 13-7, I believe they had 23 or 24 wins as well in the regular season. So they don't get in. Then obviously we talked about why Indiana State didn't get in, and for those two teams to kind of be like, hey, look, committee, this is what you missed out on. For them to play so well throughout the NIT and culminate in a great back-and-forth championship game kind of showed that the selection committee's process is kind of flawed. I mean, you can judge teams all you want based off the eye test, based off the resume, based off the net ranking, based off the quad one wins, whatever, whatever. But if you sit down and watch the games, like if you watch the NIT, Indiana State and Seton Hall both deserve to be in the tournament. And I think it was a great showing for the NIT, showing that they had two great teams like that in their tournament. And the NIT is kind of teetering off. Is it still going to be a good tournament? Are teams going to still want to play in it? But seeing those two teams that got snubbed for March Madness kind of prove it and play to the best of their ability, and not treating it like some sort of consolation prize was a good sign for the NIT and for college basketball as a whole, I would say. But, I mean, what an incredible run by Indiana State. Just seeing all the community members here in Terre Haute, you know, the kids, you know, the students at ISU, you know, just alumni, everybody who supports Indiana State. It was crazy at Hinkle Fieldhouse on Tuesday and Thursday. That arena holds, I would guess, about 10,000. 8,000 at least in both nights were full of Sycamore Blue. And just the Indiana State fans made Hinkle Fieldhouse feel like a home game for those guys. And it was the second best season, arguably, in Indiana State basketball history. Obviously, the first was the Larry Bird 1978-79 team that made the national title game. But this Sycamores team gave Terre Haute a run to remember. We're still waiting to see if Josh Schertz is going to come back or take the job at St. Louis. I would lean towards the second of those options, but nonetheless, even if he does go, he and this team gave Terre Haute, Indiana State a season they won't forget. So just want to talk about the NIT. I got super busy covering that. Monday was when I normally record these. I was going to record, but we had to go to practice at like 8 a.m., cover the press conference for the NIT. Tuesday, we obviously had the NIT game. In the last couple of days, I've been in Indy for the Morgan Wallen concert, which was an awesome concert. Morgan Wallen playing in Indy this weekend. I went on opening night on Thursday. He came out with Pat McAfee and Tyrese Halliburton out of the tunnel. At one point, he was rocking a Larry Bird Indiana State jersey. So pretty cool sports ties there. But Morgan gave a great performance, and it was good to go with my best friend Gabe and see him in concert. So enough of that spiel. Let's talk about baseball. So Major League Baseball is here. Opening day is here. We are about a week or so into the season. A lot of teams have played about 7 games, I would say. So I'm going to tell you what stands out and also give you kind of picks for how the rest of the season is going to go in terms of who I think is going to make the playoffs. So let's start as we like to do with the Cleveland Guardians. The Guardians are off to an outstanding start this season. Well, obviously playing the A's in the first series kind of helped. And We're gonna touch on the A's in a little bit too about their move to Sacramento for the next couple of years. I don't really like that, but we're just gonna keep it rolling. So let's start with the Guardians. The Guardians sit at 6-2 right now. 6-2. They took 3 out of 4 in Oakland from the A's. They dominated the first 3 days of that series, and then they lose on a walk off on the last day. Then they go to Seattle. They drop the first game of that series by 1 run, but then they win the next two. They win the series, getting some great pitching performances. And they lead the league in runs scored, I think. Yeah, the Guardians lead the American League in runs scored. And they've only allowed 20 runs. I think their run differential might be best in the big leagues. Yeah, the Guardians right now, through 8 games, lead the American League in runs scored. And lead the league in run differential. And if you would have told me that before the season, I would have looked at you like you had 3 heads. But it's really good to see this lineup kind of contributing, because that was the biggest concern for me all season long was, is this lineup going to do enough? And you take a look at the numbers. I mean, you got Stephen Kwan hitting .385. He's been awesome. Then you got Will Brennan and Andrés Giménez hitting above .300, early sample size as well. Jose's doing his thing. I really like some of the contributions they've got from Tyler Freeman and Brian Rocchio at times, two guys who kind of were platoon shortstop middle infielder guys last year. And now Rocchio's been given the chance by Steven Vogt to win that everyday shortstop job. And then you got, obviously, Tyler Freeman, who they're playing out in center field, who's producing a lot more offensively than Miles Straw would have. So I really like this, what the Guardians have done. They're tops in the leagues in on-base percentage, I believe. I'm trying to find those stats right now. Let's look. The Guardians are 5th in RBIs. They're 8th in batting average. They're 3rd in runs scored, as we said. They're 10th in on-base percentage. They're 12th in on-base plus slugging. So those offensive metrics, if they continue playing that way, it's going to be great. They just need consistent offense. This Guardians team, they need consistent offense outside of Jose Ramirez and Josh Naylor. So if you can get Andrés Giménez back to that all-star form from 2022, if you can get some of these younger guys like a Tyler Freeman, like a Brian Rocchio, consistently contributing in the lineup, it's going to make this Guardians team just that much better and take it to that other level. And then in terms of pitching, the pitching has been outstanding as well, led by Shane Bieber, who looks like the Bieber of old. He hasn't given up a run yet this season across two starts. Granted, one of those starts was against the A's, but his stuff is up. His velocity is ticking back up. He's been outstanding. Logan T. Allen's been really good. They've been pitching him out of the number two spot in the rotation for the Guardians. He's been good. He had a great start against Minnesota, or against Seattle the other day. He threw a shutout, 6 2/3 innings. And then you got Tanner Bibee, who had a great bounce back start after kind of a up and down start in Oakland against Minnesota yesterday, and the Guardians won the series opener against the Twins. They need to get healthy. They need Gavin Williams back in the rotation. But once they get their full complement of rotation with Bieber, McKenzie, Gavin Williams, Tanner Bibee, Logan T. Allen, if they can keep hitting like this, the sky, and by the sky I mean an AL Central title, is the limit for this team. There's no reason this Guardians team, with the talent they have pitching-wise, with the elite closer they have in Emmanuel Clase, they have a top 10 player in the game in Jose Ramirez, there's no reason that they shouldn't be, if they can stay healthy, if they keep the pitching healthy, in contention for the AL Central crown. And that's just my take on the matter, and they've been off to a great start this season, 6-2. They got a couple more with the Twins coming up this weekend. So let's take a look at the standings right now elsewhere among baseball. Some early season surprises. The Tigers are 5-1. They haven't exactly faced Murderer's Row in the AL Central, but still a nice start for AJ Hinch's squad in Detroit. In the AL East, the Yankees are 6-1. They swept the Astros to start the season. That was a pretty big win for the Yankees. The Astros, They threw the first no-hitter of the season, I believe. I'm trying to find it. So it looks like the Astros have won their last two games after starting 0-5? No, so the Astros on Monday, it might have been, they no-hit the Toronto Blue Jays. They won 10-0. Blanco, Ronel Blanco fires the first no-no of the season. So everybody thinks the Astros are going to be good. They're 2-5 right now. I'm still not worried about them. But that was the first no-hitter of the season. Happened a week into the season, so that was pretty significant, I would say. Then looking elsewhere, I mean, like, the Yankees are 6-1, the Red Sox 5-2, Orioles 4-2 in the AL East. In the AL West, the Rangers, defending World Series champs, are 4-2. They're top of that division. In the National League, no surprises except the Pittsburgh Pirates being 6-1, the best record and winning percentage in all of baseball. They obviously faced the Marlins and the Nationals, not exactly two great teams. The Marlins remain winless at 0-8. But, yeah, the Pirates have been off to a good start this season as well. And then the Dodgers, of course, are 7-2. So, obviously, we expect the Dodgers to win. So, real quick, I'm going to give my predictions for the MLB playoffs. Our division winners, our wild cards, and then we're division winners, wild cards winners, and I'll even give you a World Series pick. Let me make sure I got this playoff format right before I start giving you my picks. I think it's 6 teams in each, 3 division winners, 3 wild cards. Or it could be set. No, I don't think it's 7. All right, let's see. Yeah, it is 6. So 6 teams in the AL that I think are going to make the playoffs. So out of the AL Central, I feel like the AL Central is a division that at most is going to get 2 teams in, maybe only 1 team. And in my opinion, despite the nice start to the season for the Tigers, it's still a 2-team race between the Guardians and the Twins. I would lean the Twins just because they made it last year. But and if the Guardians were off to this start this season and they had Terry Francona, I'd feel a lot more confident in picking the Guardians to win this division. But no offense to Steven Vogt, but just knowing that the Twins made the playoffs last year, won a playoff series last year, I will take the Twins to win that division. In the AL East, I still think it's the Orioles division to lose. The Yankees and the Red Sox are off to nice starts early this season, but I would still take Baltimore. I mean, they got the pitching. They obviously just got Corbin Burns. They had that outstanding run last season, so I still like Baltimore to win the AL East. In the AL West, I'm going to go with the Rangers over the Astros. I think it's going to be one of those two. Maybe Seattle can sneak into the conversation there, but I would like the Rangers just in terms of the pure talent they have. They obviously won the World Series last year. It's about time they get over the hump in the AL West. So those are my 3 division winners. Twins, Orioles and Rangers. My three wild cards, I'll take the Yankees out of the AL East. I'll probably take the Astros out of the AL West. And then I'm going to go ahead and take the Guardians as the as that last wild card spot. I think the Guardians, if they play up to their potential this season, should sneak into the playoffs with about 85, 86 wins, which should be good enough for that third and final wild card spot in the American League. So those are my playoff teams in the American League. Twins, Guardians, Yankees, Orioles, Rangers, Astros, which I believe would only make the Yankees and Guardians new playoff teams this season in the American League. In the National League, I'm still going to go rock with the Braves to win the NL East. I still think they're the most talented team in all of baseball, probably. So I'll take the Braves in that division. The NL Central, I think, is kind of wide open. Realistically, I would probably think it's a two or three-team race. I like the Cubs the best out of any of those five teams. So I'm going to take the Chicago Cubs. Just think they have the best manager in Craig Counsell. They got a lot of talent on that team. So I'm going to take the Cubs to win the NL Central. And then the NL West, I mean, the Diamondbacks made the World Series last season. The Padres are always weird. The Giants, some people think the Giants are going to be competitors, but for the last 10 plus years, this has been the Dodgers division. So I'm going to take the Dodgers to win the NL West. So those are my three division winners: Braves, Cubs, Dodgers. My wild cards are the Philadelphia Phillies, the Arizona Diamondbacks, and the Cincinnati Reds. Those are my teams in the National League. So we got the Braves, Phillies, Cubs, Reds, Dodgers, Diamondbacks, my playoff teams in the National League. So that was talking baseball a little bit. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to react to the Stephon Diggs trade and preview the men's and women's Final Four.
This is wrestling legend John Cena, and you can't see me, but you're listening to this week's episode, Jack of All Trades. Here's part two.
Welcome back to Season 7, Episode 3 of the Jack of All Trades Sports Podcast. A lot of basketball to get to, including the NBA wrapping up the regular season, where I think each team stands kind of in terms of who's contenders, who's pretenders, who's kind of reeling, and who's kind of surging right now as we get towards the NBA playoffs. We're also going to talk some men's and women's Final Four in college basketball as well. That's getting ready to tip off this weekend. But we're going to start with the NFL. Big piece of NFL news in the AFC this week, as Stephon Diggs has been traded from the Buffalo Bills to the Houston Texans. Let's talk about what this means for both trades, for both teams with this trade. Starting with the Texans. Okay, so the Texans obviously had a great season last year. They win the AFC South. They win that wild card playoff game against the Browns before only to lose to the Ravens in the divisional round at Baltimore. CJ Stroud, rookie of the year, outstanding rookie season. They already got, you know, some great weapons around him in Nico Collins, Tank Dell. You know, they got Dalton Schultz. They've got Joe Mixon now. They signed Danielle Hunter. They got a good young head coach in D'Amico Ryans. And they got a great, young, talented quarterback on a rookie contract. And so what's been the recipe in some of these teams that have kind of made the Super Bowl the last couple of years? You know, the Bengals, you think about it. Joe Burrow, outstanding, extremely talented, young quarterback on a rookie contract. Jalen Hurts, rookie contract. It's been the recipe. Okay, if you can build enough talent around your superstar quarterback on a rookie deal, it gives you the best chance to win. Even Brock Purdy. I'm not saying he's a superstar, but he was on a rookie contract as well. So it's been the blueprint. So the Texans saw that. They're like, we got a CJ Stroud, a guy who's got the talent, got the potential to be a top five quarterback in the league. Let's go get him one more weapon. And they get him, Stephon Diggs, who I don't know if Diggs is, you know, the Diggs of old in Minnesota and early Buffalo, where he was arguably a top three receiver in the league. I don't think he's even top seven or eight right now. Maybe you could consider he's in the top 10, but like I could think of like a handful of guys I would take above Stephon Diggs right now. Justin Jefferson, Ja'Marr Chase, Tyreek Hill, CeeDee Lamb, AJ Brown, Amon-Ra St. Brown. That's seven right there. Mike Evans is kind of on the same line there. You know, Ayuk and Debo. You know, like there's he's a good receiver, but he's not the top of the top. And so, but I like this move for the Texans because he still had 1,400 yards last year. It gives C.J. Stroud a legit number one receiver. And now they have three really above-average receivers in Stephon Diggs, Nico Collins, and Tank Dell. And the Texans think that they have a quarterback that can compete and get them over the hump in the AFC, and now they're providing him with as much talent and resources as they can to try and get that done. So I like the move for the Texans in that regard. For the Bills, I don't hate the move either. You know, Diggs is on the north, on the other side of 30. His production has kind of taken a downtick in the last few years. Last season, remember the Bills, they fired their offensive coordinator, Ken Dorsey, about halfway through the season when they were 6-5. They finished 11-6, win the AFC East. And really, in the second half of that season, they still let Josh Allen be Josh Allen. But Diggs was involved significantly less, and they really turned into kind of a running team. And James Cook turned into one of the five best running backs in the league. So maybe their offensive identity is changing. They lose, obviously, Stephon Diggs and Gabe Davis, so they're going to be in the market for a receiver. But, I mean, they still got Dalton Kincaid. They still got James Cook. And I'm sorry, you know, Mahomes has done it. Lamar has done it, where they haven't had really the top-tier receiving talent around them, and they've still found ways to win games. And I feel like Josh Allen is the level of player and the type of player that should be able to accomplish that as well. So that's why I think, you know, it's not the worst move for the Bills to move on from Diggs, who probably is behind his best football. Like, his best football is behind him. But either way, I think it's a win move for the Texans, and I don't think it's a loss for a major, major loss for the Bills. So that's my take on that trade. Let's talk some basketball now. Enough football. Let's talk basketball. Starting in the NBA, then we'll end with men's and women's Final Four talk. All right, so let's start with the NBA. So this is as of after last night's game. Here is what the current NBA standings are looking like. Let's start in the Western Conference. In the Western Conference, the Minnesota Timberwolves are your one seed. The Denver Nuggets are your two seed. The Oklahoma City Thunder are your three seed. Then you got the Clippers at four, the Mavericks at five, and the Phoenix Suns at six, which means the play-in is the 7-8 game between the Pelicans and the Kings, and the 9-10 game between the Lakers and the Warriors. Looking in the Western Conference, I still think the team to beat is Denver. I've said it all season long. If Denver is healthy, so that means they got the, you know, the full complement of Jokic, Jamal Murray, Aaron Gordon, etc., Michael Porter Jr., the guys like that. If they're fully healthy, no one is going to beat Denver in the Western Conference, I think, in a 7-game series, just because of how dominant Jokic is and how good they are offensively. Minnesota's been a great story. The fact that they're the number one seed in the West still is kind of crazy because they missed Karl-Anthony Towns for the better half of the last 2 months. But, you know, Anthony Edwards has taken that leap into becoming a superstar. Rudy Gobert, this team's one of the best defensive teams in the league. But I still don't take them as seriously as I take the Nuggets. I like OKC. OKC, I think, has a bright, bright future. They're a little ahead of schedule where I thought they'd be this year. They have a top five player, in my opinion, this season in sport, in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. They got some talent around him, obviously, on that team as well. So I kind of like OKC to maybe make some noise. Then you got the 4-seed Clippers and the 5-seed Mavericks. I mean, that's an intriguing series. That's probably going to be the best first-round series if that turns out being the matchup, the 4-5 between the Clippers and the Mavericks, just because the amount of star power you're going to have. Obviously, the Clippers, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, James Harden, and then the Mavericks, you got Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving, which that pair has been amazing this season. I think Luka's had an MVP-type season. And then Kyrie, you know, the only thing we've said about Kyrie, we've never questioned Kyrie's talent. We've questioned his attitude, and we've questioned his injury and health, you know, history. And he's been fully healthy for the majority of this season. Bigger reason why Dallas finds themselves at five. Then you got Phoenix at six, and the Suns, like, you look at the Suns, you're like Bradley Beal, Devin Booker, Kevin Durant. Man, I really want to see if this team can make a run. And some nights it looks like the Suns can be the team that comes out of the West. And then others, it's like, okay, they're just going to lose in five in the first round. I can't get a read on them. And this, in the play-in, Lakers, Warriors, 9-10, only one of those teams is going to advance with the chance to get into the playoffs. Then the Pelicans and Kings. Kings are kind of on a downswing. I wouldn't be shocked if the Lakers jump the Kings, and the Kings would be the 9 and the Lakers would be the 8. And that would kind of be the ideal setup for the Warriors to get into the playoffs, assuming the Lakers beat the Pelicans, because then the Warriors would just have to win at Sacramento and at New Orleans to get into the playoffs. And if Steph is rested and fresh by then, I don't think that should be too big of an issue for them. So that's the Western Conference, kind of my outlook on some of the teams and how they're playing right now. In the East, the number one seed, of course, is who it's been all season long, the Boston Celtics. Over 60 wins for the Celtics. They've clearly been the best team in all of basketball all season. The two seed as of right now is the Milwaukee Bucks. Giannis and the Bucks are the two seed. The Cleveland Cavaliers are your three seed. The Magic and Knicks are your 4 and 5. And the Pacers are your six seed. So those are the top six right now. In the play-in, 7-8 is the Miami Heat against the Philadelphia 76ers. Miami close on the heels of Indiana for that last guaranteed playoff spot. I think the two play later this week, so that'll be a big game in the Eastern Conference. Of course, the Heat right now, if it was the playoffs were to start today, 7-8, it would be the Heat against the 76ers. If they can get Joel Embiid back, maybe that would be an interesting playing game. And then the top playing game is between two teams under 500. Nobody really cares, no offense. The 9 seed Chicago Bulls and the 10 seed Atlanta Hawks. So my read on the Eastern Conference is, I think it's the Celtics conference to lose. And that's just because I don't have much faith or trust in any of the other teams in the Eastern Conference. I mean, Milwaukee, absolute liabilities defensively. You got the Doc Rivers factor. Yes, they have the best player, in my opinion, in the conference, in Giannis Antetokounmpo. They have one of the best scorers still in the entire association, Damian Lillard, but they don't play much defense, and they have Doc Rivers. And Doc Rivers tends to lose, especially when his team goes up 3-2 in a series. So I can't trust the Bucks because of that regard. The Cavs, I could talk all day about the Cavs. So the Cavs are kind of struggling a little bit. Still in that 3 seed right now, but they just haven't looked right for the last month. Big reason why is because Donovan Mitchell's been in and out of the lineup with a knee injury. And part of me is like, maybe they should shut down Mitchell for the rest of the season. Seeding doesn't really matter because they're not going to win in the playoffs if Mitchell isn't as close to 100% as he can be. But I don't think the Cavs can afford or want to shut down Mitchell because they do want a higher seed. Because if they feel like it gives them a better chance to win, which it normally does in theory. But yeah, Mitchell's been dealing with a knee injury. Even when he has played, he hasn't looked quite right. He hasn't looked like the same Donovan Mitchell, the same explosiveness, the same, you know, shot making that we've grown accustomed to him seeing. And the bigger problem for the Cavs is not only is Mitchell kind of like not a shell of himself, but a little bit of a shell of himself. Darius Garland, confidence-wise, is a shell of himself. Darius Garland was so incredible a few years ago when the Cavs made the play-in and lost to Atlanta. And he was great last season as well. But this season, Garland, I mean, he just has no confidence. He's afraid to shoot, and he's not a good enough passer and pure point guard playmaker to withstand and get through rough shooting stretches. And it feels like Garland's been on a rough shooting stretch for the last month and a half. So if the Cavs want to make some noise in the playoffs, they not only need to figure out their rotation pieces down, you know, later in the game, but they need to figure out what they're going to do about the guard situation. Because obviously they're going to have to play both Mitchell and Garland, start both Mitchell and Garland, but you got to choose one to be your primary ball handler. And you got to hope those two can coexist in a playoff series, or else you're not going to win a playoff series. Obviously, I've been encouraged with the Cavs, with Evan Mobley's growth. He's been very good. Jared Allen's done his job all season long. But if the Cavs get into a matchup with the Pacers, or God forbid, the Miami Heat, I just don't like the odds for the Cavs just because of the inconsistency of their two of their three best players, in my opinion. And then the 4 and 5, the Magic and the Knicks, I mean, both are nice stories. I think the Magic are a lot ahead of schedule. They've been one of my favorite teams to follow this year. Obviously, Paolo Banchero, some other young guys on that squad. They got an outside chance at winning 48, 49 games, which would be an outstanding turnaround from last year to this year. And then the Knicks have just been bit by the injury bug, kind of like the Cavs have, but to like more of an extent. Julius Randle, they just announced Julius Randle was out for the season, I believe, with a shoulder injury. You know, OG Anunoby's been out a little bit. I mean, the Knicks feel like right now, realistically, they're kind of a one-man team. It's just Jalen Brunson and whoever can kind of get into the lineup semi-healthy, you know? So, and then, yeah, obviously the play-in teams. I mean, the only one out of those four that I would consider a legit threat in the Eastern Conference, of course, is the Miami Heat, just because what they've done in the past. But, I don't know, the Heat have sneaky been kind of bad recently, too, in terms of offensive efficiency, stuff like that, but that's my read on kind of both conferences. I would still pick a Celtics-Nuggets final, like I said, I believe preseason. That's where I would lean there. But yeah, we will see, of course, how it unfolds. All right, let's get to men's and women's final Four talk. before we say goodbye for this week's show. Let's start with the Women's Final Four, which is in Cleveland, Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse this week. Tickets are insane. I mean, it really speaks to the draw that women's college basketball is becoming, the buzz around the sport that Caitlin Clark has generated. Tickets, my friend Krista said that tickets were like $630, and I looked today, and they're going for over a grand some places for some of these games. So that's just the effect of Caitlin Clark. But this Final Four for the women's side is really, really fascinating. They have the best team, an undefeated team in South Carolina. They have the best player in Caitlin Clark. They have the player with the greatest comeback story on the season, which is UConn's Paige Bueckers, a.k.a. Paige Buckets, who's come back from countless knee surgeries, countless injuries, to continue to be one of the best players in the country. That's going to be an outstanding matchup in the national semifinal. Caitlin Clark and Paige Bueckers going at it. Interested to see who's going to win that one. And then you got North Carolina State, who is the gritty underdog that no one picked to get here, kind of. You know, it's going to be a fun one to watch. So without further ado, let's get on in it as we see who we think is going to win this Final Four on the women's side. So obviously the big story is Caitlin Clark. Can Caitlin Clark do it, wrap up her career at Iowa with a national championship? I still think South Carolina is the best team. I mean, it's going to be tough to knock them out. Obviously, Caitlin Clark is the player that can do it. I believe that Caitlin Clark and Iowa knocked out South Carolina last year, if I could be wrong. But yeah, so South Carolina, NC State, Iowa beating UConn. I think South Carolina is going to have no trouble with NC State in the first national semifinal on the women's side. They're double-digit favorites. Camila Cardoso and company won three of their tournament games by double digits, survived a scare in the Sweet 16 from Indiana. The Wolfpack could probably keep this in within single digits. They went 7-3 against ranked opponents. But I think the North Carolina State's going to have to play a perfect game to knock off South Carolina for one of the most extraordinary upsets in the women's Final Four. I just don't really see it happening. And then for UConn, Iowa, I mean, it's going to be the story is the superstar matchup between Caitlin Clark and Paige Bueckers. Both might score over 30 in this game. I think Clark owns a slight edge in terms of the superstar matchup because of the higher point totals and three-point range that she has displayed throughout her career. Iowa also has more depth, I think, than UConn does. UConn is like 6 or 7 deep because of a bunch of injuries they had early in the season. And I think if Iowa can, a big key for Iowa, I think, will be to get UConn into foul trouble. And if that happens, the Huskies could struggle to stop Clark. And I think that's what's going to happen. I would take Iowa over UConn, which would set up the matchup that everybody wants. South Carolina versus NC State, which would be, or South Carolina versus Iowa, excuse me, which would be the best team versus the best player in Caitlin Clark. And I don't know, it's tough to pick that game. Because on one hand you got the best player arguably that the sport has seen in terms of women's college basketball. But then on the other side, you've got South Carolina 34-0. It's tough. I would probably Now I don't know. Now I'm like kind of torn on it. I know I got to pick either South Carolina or Caitlin Clark in Iowa. Let's see. So I think it is going to be Iowa, South Carolina, and I really think that that's what the committee really wants. I mean, I feel like a lot of people are picking South Carolina, but I think I'm going to go with Iowa. I think I'm going to go with Caitlin Clark, and a lot of the reason why I'm picking Iowa is because of Caitlin Clark. The tournaments have kind of almost gone in reverse. South Carolina was pretty dominant in the first two rounds, shaky in the Sweet 16 in the Elite Eight, and on the other hand, Iowa was kind of shaky in the first two rounds. They get that 10-point win against Colorado that was a lot closer than 10 points, but Iowa's been dominant in the past two rounds in the Sweet 16, the Elite Eight. They beat, obviously, Iowa beat South Carolina last season. I just think Iowa's a team that won't be denied, and more specifically, Caitlin Clark is a player that is not going to be denied. I mean, I thought Iowa would struggle with LSU because LSU, I thought, was going to out-rebound Iowa, and they did, but Iowa still was able to win that game. So even though South Carolina is a way better rebounding team and will have an advantage in that area of the game, I think Iowa's not going to be denied with Caitlin Clark. And I think it's the year Caitlin Clark kind of wraps up her storybook career with a national title in Cleveland. On the men's side, two of the same Final Four from the women's side. We got UConn taking on Alabama. And then we got North Carolina State taking on Purdue. So let's start with Alabama to kind of talk about, you know, what their strengths are. I mean, they're the highest scoring offense in the nation, 91 points per game. They play at a super fast pace led by Mark Sears. They make a lot of threes. They're a good offensive rebounding team. They're going to get a matchup against UConn, who's been clearly the best team all season long. They're 35-3. They beat Illinois by 25 in the Elite Eight. That game was tied at 23 late in the first half, and then UConn went on a 30-0 run. 30-0 run. I mean, this team is outstanding. They shoot 16.1% better on two-pointers than they allow. They're a great rebounding team. Top five in both adjusted offensive and defensive efficiency. They're dominant. I mean, they haven't skipped a beat from last season at all. They're a juggernaut, and they're going to be very, very tough to beat. Then we have the Cinderella on the men's side. North Carolina State, the 11-seeded Wolfpack, who beat Marquette in the Sweet 16 and then beat Duke in the Elite Eight. I mean, this North Carolina State team, they were a missed free throw, a made free throw away, and a buzzer beater away from not even making the NCAA tournament, from not even making the ACC semifinals in the ACC tournament. But instead, this North Carolina State team rallied around. They've won 9 games in 19 days, all 9 of those games elimination games, essentially. And now they find themselves just 2 wins away from a national title. And I really liked what I've seen from this NC State team. Obviously, DJ Burns and stuff. They don't commit many turnovers. They have a lot of confidence, and they're the hottest team in this Final Four. And they're, last but not least, they're facing the number 1-seeded Purdue Boilermakers, who are 33-4, who got a close win against number 2 Tennessee. Obviously, they run through Zach Edey. That's probably the biggest strength for Purdue. They shoot 41% from three. They assist on over 66% of their field goals made. But Edie's kind of been carrying this team, and they are going to go as far as he goes. So I'm interested to see which of these teams can stop Zach Edey. Alabama obviously playing for a lot of respect. They were good enough to win it all in 2021 and 2023, but they just couldn't quite get over the hump. Connecticut obviously trying to repeat. North Carolina trying to, show the redemption story. And Purdue, also the big redemption story for Purdue, because Purdue obviously lost to Fairleigh Dickinson, the 16 seed a year ago, and now they're trying to do what Virginia did when they lost to 16 seeded UMBC and win the national title the year after. So it's going to be a very, very exciting Final Four on the men's side. I think, let me give you what I think all three of these teams need to do to cut down the nets. Then I'll give you my predictions for both games, and I'll tell you who I have winning the national title. So Alabama, they need to make it rain. They need to shoot the ball well from three. If they could shoot the ball from the outside well, they're going to have a great chance to win. They've won 19 of their 21 games this season where they shot 50% or more from three. And the only loss was to Purdue and Zach Edey, who counted their triple, or one of those losses was to Purdue and Zach Edey, who scored 35 points to kind of cancel out the threes that Alabama was making. But yeah, Alabama needs to make shots, make threes, and shoot at a high clip from beyond the arc. They also need to be better at defense, because if they just make threes, it's not going to be enough to knock out UConn. They need to not allow 90.4 points like they've allowed over their last 14 games. And then the last thing Alabama needs to do to give themselves the best chance to win the title, I think, is they got to play at their fast pace, fly up and down the floor, make opponents uncomfortable, maximize the amount of possessions you can have, and maybe force UConn into some mistakes and capitalizing on some of those mistakes that they made. So that's for Alabama. I think Alabama needs to make threes at a high clip, play better defense, and play at their pace, making opponents uncomfortable. UConn has their three steps. The first one is UConn's just got to continue what they're doing. They just got to control the pace. They just got to play their game, and they're going to win. I mean, they're going to have a massive advantage in the paint. So I think that's where they should focus most of their offensive game plan on. And they should also attack Alabama on the defensive side. I also think they need to share the rock. UConn does. Mostly Tristan Newton. UConn's a perfect 26-0 this season when Newton tallies at least 5 assists. They're 0-2 when he takes at least 18 shots. So Newton's just got to, you know, be a playmaker, and they got to pass the ball around every now and then for them to continue to have a best chance to win this game. And then for the other third key for UConn to try and win a title, continue to dominate with defense. They have the most efficient offense in the country, but their defense has been so good. They've held 5 consecutive opponents to 58 points or fewer. It's very, very unlikely they'll be able to do that to Alabama, but their defense is going to be crucial if UConn wants to get this repeat done. For NC State, they got to let DJ Burns do his thing. He is such a fun player to watch. I mean, it's watching him go on one-on-one with Zach Edey will be quite different, but I think it still could have a chance to work. They need the other DJ to work as well, DJ Horn. He's averaged 17 over his last 8 games. They need him to be good, and they need him to get hot from outside. They also got to stay out of foul trouble. This is probably the toughest part for NC State in terms of their path to a title, because staying out of foul trouble against Zach Edey is super hard because a lot of people don't know how to officiate him, because they feel like every time he goes up for a shot, he gets fouled. You know, every time he gets held, like, in the post just slightly, they call it a foul. The Wolfpack don't have much depth, though, so if they get one guy in foul trouble, that's going to be a problem for them. For Purdue, it's simple. They need to own the paint and glass. They need to move the ball, and they need to keep playing with fire. That's what I would think. My predictions, I think Purdue is going to beat North Carolina State, I would say, by about 10 to 15. And I think UConn's going to beat Alabama by, I would say, like 10, which would set up UConn versus Purdue Monday night at 9:20 on TBS. I think it's going to be an outstanding game between the best player in Zach Edey and the best team in UConn. But I just don't see anybody beating UConn. I mean, just how dominant they've been. Dan Hurley, you know, the 30-0 run. Obviously, we could talk more about this matchup if it comes to fruition before Monday. But I like UConn to get the job done. Donovan Klingon, the rest of their team, to get the job done, despite Purdue having the, no question, best player in the series in Zach Edey. So I got Purdue and UConn, with UConn winning on the men's side, and then I got Iowa over South Carolina on the women's side for my national title games. That's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram at Joat Sports Pod. That's at Joat Sports Pod. You can also give me a follow on Twitter at Jack Burney TV or at The Real Jay Burns. That's at The Real Jay Burns. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Jack of All Trades. We'll be back soon with another award-winning episode. Until then, I've been Jack Burney, signing off.